National Council of Jewish Women. Today is February 7, 1997. We are interviewing Dr. Walter Jacob in his study. This is tape 13, side 25. I am Gabrielle Denman, and the recorder is Mary Harris. Rabbi Jacob, tell us something so we can check if your voice is coming through. How are you today?
I will do my best not to present things in chronological order so that it will be like the other thing.
Dr. Jacob, would you tell us a little about your project researching the synagogues of Western Pennsylvania, please?
Sure. This is, actually for me, it's a relatively minor project, but I think it'll work out very nicely. There are lots of synagogues in the small towns of Western Pennsylvania which have already been sold and turned to other uses, and others for which this is going to happen as the communities either dwindle or disappear. And that's because the economics of Western Pennsylvania has changed often in the last 100 years, 150 years, but it's changed more radically in the last 40 years than before. And not only the economics, but also the possibility of living in Pittsburgh and still having a plant or a store an hour away from Pittsburgh. And of course, it's much nicer to live both in a larger Jewish community and a larger general. So a fair number of people have opted to do that. Before these synagogues disappear, I thought it was important to report them. There are perhaps 60 synagogues and some 45 communities, and most of them have not been photographed, some have. So we're going to collect those photographs or go out and photograph them, interior and exterior, whatever remains. And then look in the county records to see who was involved in chartering the congregation and who were the architect. Then try to gather some memorabilia from individuals who grew up there, who currently live there, and some memoirs, knowing full well that, first of all, may not be accurate, which is all right, because we're just interested in the general background, and we're not trying to reconstruct the history of Brownsville or Connellsville or some other places like that. But it will show a pattern, I think will be interesting, and it's being done under the auspices of the Associated American Jewish Museums, the Rhode of Sholem Gallery, the Western Pennsylvania Historical Society, and possibly the American Jewish Archives in Cincinnati. Each of these organizations has a somewhat different interest in this. The Associated American Jewish Museums would like to have a traveling exhibit out of this, and the Rhode of Sholem Gallery would like to display it here. We want to do this as a traveling exhibit so that other large cities will be encouraged to do that for their satellite communities before those disappear. The archives and the Historical Society will benefit because they will get the records and the pictures. All of us together will produce a small book for this purpose, too. The symposium that's planned for next summer will focus on a sort of a background for this. So a professor from the University of Pittsburgh will deal with the changing patterns of Western Pennsylvania small towns. A professor from the University of Louisville who has done something similar to this in Kentucky, will deal with the immigrant population, what brought people to small towns, and what got them to stay there. And I'll deal with synagogue architecture, both European and American influences. And there's one other thing that may come out of this. If we discover some gem of a building, a little town. But then we will try to see to it that it's restored as a historical monument. I don't know whether that will happen, because we'll have to wait and see what's out there. Support is not going to take much support, because all of the work will be done on a voluntary basis, and it's already pretty well organized. But the only thing that will take some funding will be the exhibit, and that'll be simple, because it has to be capable of traveling easily. I'm sure we'll get some support for that. I already have some support for it. And the publication, again, there are some people who have indicated the interest without putting a dollar figure on it. And you know, nowadays, if you scan photographs, and there's a technology that if you are willing to learn it and willing to put in the time, even the printing need not be terribly expensive.
Speaking of historical monuments, when did our plaque come onto the show? When was the show started?
There are two plaques. One is a historical building as far as the state is concerned. That happened in the early 1960s. The second is that we were put on the Register of National Historic Landmarks, and that happened sometime in the 1970s. There are, I think, five synagogues in the United States that are so designated. And of course, what makes this exceptional is not only that it's interesting architecturally, but that and that we've restored it faithfully. There are no changes in the restoration. We were very careful to do that. Is that it's still in use, and not only incidentally in use as some synagogues, like the synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island, but is the central place of worship and education of this congregation. We're lucky. That's exceptional.
Now, we did talk about the architecture of the temple earlier, but will you tell us a little more about the process, the restoration process? Did they have original blueprints? What kind of artisans did the tile work with?
Well, this was a very difficult process, because when the committee met in the late 80s, and we were driven to go in that direction because we had continual problems with leaks in the roof and also in some of the brickwork. We could have repaired it at minimal cost and kept doing it, but decided upon a closer look that the building deserved more than that. So the first decision was, should we keep the building or should we anew. That was an easy one. The committee immediately decided that we wanted this building and wanted to restore it. We then asked five large restoration, national restoration firms to look at it and to present us with a proposal. One of them, and they all did rather nicely, but one of them, I'd have to get you the name of that firm, really did their homework, because they looked into the we did not have blueprints from 1912. They looked into the architectural magazines of those days, and they found, because this was an unusual building, it had at that point the largest freestanding dome in the United States. In other words, unsupported. It's the construction is Gustavina tile, which means that one tile extends slightly over the previous one, and this holds the roof up.
I can't believe.
Sort of. And it's an interesting construction form. So they found pictures of the building without the dome. They found pictures of the building with scaffolding. And then they found that this tile company had archives which were still in existence in New York. So they looked at those. So clearly, this was the place which the firm with which we should go, because they were going to do this faithfully and look after the detail. So we decided to do that, and then they presented us with a bid that was going to cost a great deal. It ended up costing $8.5 million. And we knew that we would be unable to use the building for slightly more than a year. And so they started working very rapidly, encased the entire building in scaffolding. Then the whole thing was encased in plastic so that they could work through the season. So it was quite a sight. Got lots of photographs. I took everything out of the interior, and all the pews, those enormous chandeliers, which could not be taken out the door without it being totally dismantled, and proceeded with the restoration, which meant taking off all the facing brick of it, its layers of brick, pretty much like you've seen in Rome, where the facing brick, or the facing stones, have usually been taken off. And what you see underneath is not particularly beautiful, but it's sturdy. Looked at it, put back as much as they could, or had other brick that matched completely, made for them. Took off all the terracotta, saved whatever they could, and the rest of it they had duplicated. So all the terracotta way up high, which nobody can really see, only with difficulty, has been completely restored.
But did they have to make new molds?
Yes. Made lots of new molds. There's lots of terracotta work up there. It had been extensively damaged by the atmosphere in Pittsburgh. It was 50 years of smoke and grime. And by an effort, a well-meant effort, after the Second World War to clean it, where acid was used, and of course that didn't help. Then the copper roof had to be entirely replaced. That was taken off. And as you know, you may not know, there are two levels. What you see up there is 20 feet higher than what you see on the exterior interior. But one of these days I can walk you up there. It's an interesting climb into the dome.
They take new members up on the tour. I remember. We went.
Into the dome?
Mm-hmm. Before the restoration.
No, they don't, because, first of all, nowadays, a fair number of our new members are way too old to climb ladders.
I was up there.
You have to climb exterior ladder. And they've also now locked it because confirmation kids used to go up there. In the interior, there was scaffolding 6 feet apart. The pews were completely taken out and repurposed. And they worked on taking off the sound baffling material, because we had great problems until 1910 when they put a sound deadening material on the interior walls with acoustics. The acoustic quality of the building was terrible. But they opted for live sound rather than dead sound. And in order to help that, the only change they made were those plexiglass baffles that you see in the front of the temple that redirect the sound to some extent. And they are controllable. They can move them up and down. And then they took the skylight out, then we refurbished it, and as they went further along, they also, the congregation also decided to repoint the windows, so all the windows came out, and a protecting sheets of heavy whatever were put on the outside. I think some of those existed already before, but they were replaced. So this was a major project. I followed it closely and several times climbed up on the interior and on the exterior to the very top of the building to get a wonderful view of Oakland. They weren't too anxious to have me up there. In order to protect the organ, which is a historic instrument and has a plaque of its own, it's the only survivor of that kind of thing from the turn of the century. That whole thing was encased in wood. And then, of course, as we proceeded toward, it was a mess because it meant that services, all services were in the Levy Hall or in the Freehof Hall, and there was lots of dust, dirt everywhere. All the roofs were replaced on all the buildings, and some other brickwork was done on all the buildings too. So the whole thing generally was a great mess for those a year and a half, 2 years. When it was close to finished, I think I've told you about that. We had a fire, an electrical fire.
Yeah, tell us. I remember
that. Probably due to carelessness of a worker. The roof was not yet on, so it looked more dramatic than it actually was. The fire was in the foyer, and the smoke went out the top, and it must have been quite dramatic. See, I saw pictures of it. It did about $500,000 worth of damage, but it delayed matters. And you know, the interior is wood panels, so it could have been much, much worse. At the time, I think I mentioned this before, Irene and I were on vacation. We were camping in a tent in the Olympic National Park, about as far away as you could get in North America. And on that day, had a lovely day at the seashore, and we came home very late, after 10 o'clock. We found a note, turned on the tent, called Pittsburgh. It's not a family emergency, so we called, and by that time, and found out, of course, that the synagogue had burned, that the fire was out. It was, by that time, already night. Must have been close to midnight by the time we got around to call. There weren't too many people to talk to. The next morning, I talked to our administrator, Susan Trivers, and she indicated that the fire was out. The fire company had been there through the night to make sure. That the hoses and everything else that had been dragged through the halls were gone. The insurance adjusters were going to come in. So there was nothing that I could have done by coming home. So I told her I'd be home in a week as planned. When I got here, there was still plenty of smell of smoke, all of that at the building. What was crucial at that point was we needed the building for the holidays. And so we really had to push to finish. And that was a major push because, and we had already planned a whole series of dedication events. Planned a concert. The Shabura was coming the next month. Something for every month for the next year. It was a fairly complex program. And it was either to abandon all that or to move ahead. Everybody pushed very hard. The last of the carpeting, and some of that carpeting is complex because it has different color patterns skived into it, was put down on the day, on noon hour before Rosh Hashanah. And of course, we'd had no chance to really test the sound system. It worked, not terribly well, but it worked. Pewback speakers for which we opted, although people did warn us that they sometimes were problematic, and I can attest to the fact that they are problematic. The sound is not what you really would like it to be. But we opted for it. And it's an immense wiring job. If you ever go into the crawl space under the tent, where even you have to go, it is a tangle of wires, and when something goes wrong someplace, in some section, it's not easy to discover. So we had services, and everything went pretty well. There was one other catch in all this, and that was really a bit of a nuisance, more than a bit of a nuisance. 2 weeks, I believe, or a week before the holidays, our president at that point, Marvin Joseph, had never really gotten along with our new temple administrator, Susan Critters. So 2 weeks before the holidays, we decided that they simply could, that this was not going to work out, and she was asked to resign. So there I was, no administrator, a building which still needed a lot of work, and a complex program for the next year. And then of course they went through the process of finding a new administrator, and Jeff Herzog became the new administrator. But for the next 4 months, I was rabbi and temple administrator. And did my best to see to it that everything ran properly, but told the board that I was not going to look into the financial part of this at all, because to become well acquainted with that and to start talking to people about dues, I felt that was not my prerogative or my interest.
How was the restoration plan?
We had a major campaign with a lot of people doing a great deal of hard work. The president during that whole period was Sidney Bucis, and he did a tremendous amount of work on this, really dedicated himself to it, and there were endless meetings with individuals, and some of them worked and some of them didn't work, and that accompanied him occasionally to people to ask, you know, when there were big gifts, for $1 million. And most of the time, you walked out of there knowing that you were not going to get $1 million. Once or twice, the whole delegation went. Dr. Friot went, too. I remember those trips. But there was a lot of enthusiasm in the congregation and a lot of hard workers. Lou Brody, for example, worked extremely hard. Norman Berger, who was never interested in the slightest recognition, put in a tremendous amount of work. Lester Harrop was the chairman of the building committee. And of course, that meant endless supervision and, more than that, decision-making. We had, aside from this large architectural forum, now I remember at least one of the names, Ehrenberg and something and something. We had local architects who were involved. I'll think of the local architect visualizing, but I can't think of his name at the moment. But there were lots of decisions that had to be made. And you had to bring in somebody from the congregation, and Lester Harrop was constantly here, those sorts of things. People were very generous. And I think they were generous because we have not bothered them very often. The previous time in which we did some work on the building was about 25 years earlier. This building, which we now sit, was erected in the 50s. So as we hadn't troubled for people often, they were willing to be generous contributors, and there were some very major gifts, so that the temple itself, the main building, was restored through the generosity of Henry Posner Jr. and his wife. That was a very major gift. And there were other gifts that were also quite sizable. But everybody participated, and that was, I think, the good part of it. Whether the gift was in the millions or whether it was just a few dollars, it showed a real concern for the congregation and for the building. The one thing I'm sorry about, that it was not possible at that point to push further, was that we did not then, let's say, add another million or two for the school room. But there was a reluctance to go that far and to commit to that extent. And we ended up with something like, when it was all finished, $600,000 or $700,000, which had to be raised. It was pledged, but often through bequests. So rather than waiting for those to occur, there was an effort made to raise the additional funds, and that succeeded. I think this also had another major impact. This was really the first statement on the part of the Jewish community that we intended to stay in the city. And by putting in the end, more than $9 million into this building, this site, that I think encouraged the Federation and the Jewish Center later on to put in the money necessary for the rebuilding of the community center in Squirrel Hill, and now the Weinberg Terrace, and all the other things, which amounted to something like between $30 and $40 million. But we started that process. So a definite vote of confidence for the city. Could it be relocated somewhere else?
Do you have anything to say about relocating the Jewish Center from Bellfield Avenue in the heart of Oakland to Squirrel?
Well, but that's a decision that had been made much, much earlier.
Oh, really?
Yes. The Squirrel Hill building was built, I believe, in the 60s. 60s or early 70s. Something like that.
The current one?
No, the current one was torn down.
Yeah.
The previous building was torn down. They made a mistake when they put up the previous building. Let's go back a little bit. The building on Bellfield, opposite the University of Pittsburgh, was shown to be both inadequate and wrongly cited, largely for parking, because it isn't that far from Squirrel Hill, but it was impossible to find a place where you could build an adequate garage. So there was a decision made, late 60s, early 70s, to build in two places, one in Squirrel Hill and in the East End. And those buildings were put up. The East End proved to be a mistake, and really too late, because the community had already begun to move out. Squirrel Hill proved to be an error in a different sense, that they made no provisions for expansion. In other words, the structural steel that was used, was incapable of housing additional floors. So when the building was too small, they decided to relocate on the same side toward the old building, which was not very old, totally down and start it over again. And now, of course, have added onto it, and with the Weinberg Terrace as home for the well-aging, that really provides us with a very good center there. And the rebuilding of the Home for the Aged on the same side, on Brownsville Road, is also close enough, and will even be closer, because that area between Squirrel Hill and Brownsville Road, which was a slag dump for U.S. Steel, has now settled long enough that you can build on it. And this year they're supposed to put in these, the water and sewage and electric, and then the plan is to put 300 or 400 homes on that site. And so that'll be directly contiguous to the Home for the Aged. And the Home for the Aged, by the way, is now in a beautiful location. It does not speak well for, hate to say this, because a great many people that I know or knew were involved with the Home for the Aged. Not necessarily its establishment on that site,